Thanks for joining us on The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. This hour, we're talking about food, how to grow it in responsible, sustainable ways while still producing high-quality, healthful options. Our guest says we're making assumptions about what fits that bill. Join in the discussion. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. How often do you eat organic food? Is that something you seek out? Why do you choose that? Maybe you put an emphasis on buying local products. Help us understand why you choose to spend your money on foods like that as opposed to things that are imported. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Robert Parlberg is a research associate at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's a political scientist specializing in international agriculture and food policy, and he wrote the book Resetting the Table, Straight Talk About the Food We Grow and Eat. Robert, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Keeley. It's great to be with you and great to be back in Wisconsin.
We appreciate it. Your book, it goes against this idea that eating organic, locally sourced food is what we need to be healthy. Why do you think our dietary thinking needs to be reset?
Well, if you look at the consequences of scaling up organic and local food, it wouldn't improve our diet. If you scaled up local food, you'd have to do without imported fresh fruits and vegetables. And that's a significant part of our food supply today. 50% of our fresh fruits are imported. 30% of our fresh vegetables are imported. If we relocalized, we'd have to replace all of those healthy foods, especially off-season in the wintertime, with something homegrown, maybe in a greenhouse somewhere in Wisconsin or Massachusetts. And that would be terribly expensive, and that would drive up the price of healthy food. And so our diets would actually worsen. As it is, we don't consume enough fresh fruits and vegetables. Only 1 in 10 Americans consumes the recommended daily servings of fresh fruits and vegetables. Why make that more difficult by eliminating all of the healthy imported products that are now available to us? I should mention also seafood, another healthy food. 80% of that is imported. We couldn't possibly replace all that imported seafood with something locally grown.
For years, we've heard messages like eat local foods. What do you think would happen if we limited our diets to only locally grown foods? Could we still achieve a healthful diet?
Well, as I said, we'd have to find some way to replace mm-hmm. all of those imports of healthy foods. And I'm not sure it could be done at an affordable price. The fact is, we're not relocalizing our food system. Consumers don't want to do it. They want year-round availability. They want convenience. They want affordability. They want choice. Locally grown food doesn't give them those things. That's why we're actually going away from locally grown food. Instead of relocalizing, our food system is continuing to globalize. In 1990, 10% of our food was imported. Now it's closer to 20%. So the local food idea has an emotional tug, and it's wonderful in season to make purchases directly from farmers at farmers markets or in CSAs, but that's not the direction our food system is going. If you look at the latest census of agriculture, you can see that if you add up all of the sales made by farmers direct to consumers at farmers markets or CSAs or roadside stands or pick your own, and then if you add in all the farm to table and farm to school sales and all of the sales made through local food hubs off the supermarket grid, all of that adds up to only 2% of farm sales in the United States. So being realistic, we're not going to relocalize our food system. And to some extent, I'm glad that we're not, because as I say, it would compromise the diversity of food that's available, especially in the cold winter months in our marketplace.
Robert Parlberg is a research associate at the Harvard Kennedy School. We're talking about his book, Resetting the Table, about the food we grow and eat. Your calls are welcome here on the Ideas Network at 800-642-1234. We're talking about locally grown food, our global economy when it comes to food and different products, and also about the way that we produce and grow the food. What questions do you have? What experiences do you have as a grower? 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. Robert, I want to deal with this word organic because I think that we've had many conversations on this network in the past about how organic does not necessarily equal a better product. And that's actually one of the things that you want to underscore, that organic is fine and good, but it's not necessarily scalable.
Yeah, organic food is a little bit like local food in that regard. If you once again go to USDA reports, you'll find that only 2% of farm sales made in the United States today are certified organic products. It turns out organic food is popular with consumers. They're willing to pay a premium to get it, but it's not especially popular with farmers because the organic rule does not allow them to use any synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, zero. And that makes producing food more costly and less convenient. And so there's not a huge supply of locally or nationally produced or anywhere produced organic food. But if we ignored those preferences and did scale up organic food, once again, it wouldn't be good for our diet because organically grown foods cost organically grown produce costs on average about 54% more than conventionally grown produce. So if consumers were forced to pay that much more, they would buy less, and once again, they would consume less produce, and that would once again be bad for our diet. And this is what you alluded to, the assumed benefits of organic foods have not been demonstrated scientifically. Studies done at Stanford University, meta-studies of hundreds of peer-reviewed articles show that organically grown foods are not more nutritious than conventionally grown foods. The organic community says, yes, they are. They point to organic milk. They say organic milk has 50% more beta-carotene than conventional milk, and that's true. But conventional milk has so little beta-carotene that 50% more than almost nothing is still almost nothing. Are organically grown foods safer? Well, my book reviews the evidence on pesticide residues, and it shows that pesticide use and pesticide residues are carefully regulated by the Food and Drug Administration in the United States. And the residues that can be found on conventional produce in the United States are in concentrations that are 100 times lower, which is much more than 100%, 100 times lower than a residue that might have been toxic. Now, we've all heard warnings about the dirty dozen crops that have the heaviest pesticide residues, but that's a scare talk that's a little bit misleading. Think about it. Imagine you had 100 products that are essentially clean. Well, 12 of those 100 would still be the dirtiest. And so you could call them dirty, but in fact, they're clean. Warning people away from the dirtiest fruits and vegetables is a little bit like warning a swimmer away from the deepest end of a wading pool. It's simply misleading. Pesticide residues are a serious problem in developing countries where the chemicals are less well regulated, where they're sprayed right up to the moment that the products are picked and that they're sold unwashed. It's an occupational hazard in particular, but the science tells us that it's not a serious problem in wealthy countries like the United States.
Robert Parlberg is a political scientist who's written a book about how we define quality food, from the product itself to the way that it's grown. He's with us all hour long here on The Morning Show. There's room for your call at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Keely Boltina. Our conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. Some people argue that organic food grown on small local farms is the best way to feed our communities. Our guest says that's not necessarily the case. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Nearly half of all Americans claim to prefer organic food, and our guest Robert Parlberg says it isn't automatically better than food grown using pesticides or produced on large-scale farms. What do you think? Call now at 800-642-1234, just like Sylvia in Clear Lake. Good morning, Sylvia.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Yes, my husband and I grow grass-finished beef in Clear Lake. But I started my life as in the inner city. I spent 40 years in public relations, and I very well know what it's like to try to twist people's minds with different kinds of information. So thank you for allowing calls. One, more and more people do want local. And by local, I just don't mean going to that little farm and making the whole thing sound very romantic, but they're looking at community food webs where you may have farms from within a 50-mile radius working together to supply food of all kinds to a growing local community. And that was proven out during COVID, where people came out of the woodwork looking for local foods and traveled well over 100 miles to find it. And the last point I'll make is that the industrial food complex has very well understood this growing trend towards supporting, not only supporting, but buying real food value that's local, because they've tried to co-opt so many of the terms like sustainable, like local, like family farm. So I really, really counter most of the ideas that your guest is providing. People do want it, and it absolutely can be provided, because there are the farms and there is the will both on the grower side and on the consumer side.
Sylvia, thank you for bringing up those points and adding that to the discussion. Robert, Sylvia's point right at the end is this is possible. We can make this happen, you know, and we can work to scale this appropriately to our consumers. What do you hear in that you can agree with?
Well, I do hear things I can agree with. I'm not a big fan of what the caller referred to as the industrial food web. My book spends quite a bit of time criticizing heavily food companies that turn the products of our farms into ultra-processed, virtually addictive, unhealthy foods laden with excess sugar, salt, and fat. We've been talking about diets in America. Our American diet is in many ways a calamity. Since the 1960s, obesity rates in the United States have tripled. It's now up to 42%. And I spend a lot of time in my book blaming the industrial food web, not the farm web, but the industrial food web. And that's food manufacturing companies, the retail chains, the food service chains, especially the fast food and the full service national chains, blaming them for making these virtually addictive, craveable products that condition us to want more, that spike our insulin and send the calories straight to the fat cells, that hit a bliss point in our mouth and condition us to want to eat these foods again. They then surround us with these foods all day long, and they advertise them heavily, including to children. This is what's broken in our food system, and I certainly want to do something in response to that, but I don't blame these problems on large-scale, specialized agricultural producers.
why can't you point the finger at them when our caller says they're using the language? They see what people want, and they're trying to convince us that the large-scale farms are actually those local producers meeting the needs of the consumers.
Well, I'm not sure that a large-scale baby greens, baby spinach producer in California is shipping products to the East Coast and claiming that they're that they're local. At least I haven't seen that. One thing that I have seen is large scale distant organic farms claiming to be the organic farms that we imagine in our minds. If you go to Texas, you will find organic dairy farms with 18,000 cows. One of these farms produces as much milk as 450 organic dairy farms in Wisconsin. Now, people are fixated on organic certification, and these big farms in Texas, this is industrial organic is what it is. The Cornucopia Institute calls it factory milk. I think people are being deceived by the organic halo when they purchase this milk. It doesn't fit in any way their imagined view of what organic production should look like.
We're talking with Robert Parlberg, who's written the book Resetting the Table, Straight Talk About the Food We Grow and Eat. And we're taking your questions, your thoughts, email ideas at WPR.org. We've also got Mark from Wisconsin Dells on the line. Hey, Mark.
Hi, how you doing? In one of my retirement jobs, I'm a retired university professor who was in agriculture specializing in vertebrate nutrition. Today, I'm driving around in Amish country in the Driftless area where the real organic farms are. But the reason I called is because I've been waiting to actually call with this information a couple of times. I'm also a crop inspector, and WCIA is right there at UW, headquartered there. And I have inspected seed crops on lands that were cleared. Tens of thousands of acres in Wisconsin have been cleared so that the producers of that seed could say that's organically produced seed because the forest has been there so long there haven't been any chemicals put there, agricultural chemicals. Now, I think it's quite a paradox that we're producing organic seed and actually doing it for people in Illinois who don't have any forest left to clear to have their own organic seed production.
Mark, thank you so much for bringing that up. And you mentioned the WCIA, which is the Wisconsin Crop Improvement Association. I want to make sure Robert has a chance to respond to that because, Robert, Mark's explanation of clearing forest land to create more organic farming, it fits with some of your assessment of how industrial farming can actually help us preserve land and environmental resources. How?
Well, first, I should say that the organic rule does introduce a number of distortions into our resource management practices. Organic farmers can't use synthetic herbicides, so many of them control weeds with gas-powered flamethrowers. And many of them control weeds with plastic mulch that's non-biodegradable, that goes to a landfill. We have to look under the hood when it comes to the practices that are adopted in order to fit into the organic rule. But when it comes to land use, we've reduced requirements to clear land dramatically by embracing modern precision agriculture techniques, by embracing modern farming techniques. Everyone thinks that, we've blanketed the landscape with corn and soybeans, but crop yields are now so high that we need less land to grow much more of the crop. If you compare to 1940, the United States today is producing five times as much corn on 20% less land. And compared to half a century ago, we're using much less in the way of pesticides for every bushel produced. And in absolute terms, U.S. agriculture has reduced insecticide use by 80% since 1972. We use, per bushel of production, we use less water, less energy, less land, less labor, and fewer chemicals. The older way of farming looks more sustainable from a distance, but that's mostly an illusion. The older way of farming, back in 1940, we were producing only one third as much food as we're producing today. And we were still doing environmental damage. Think about the Dust Bowl of the 1930s.
Yeah. And I'm going to pause right there because we've got more conversation ahead and want to get deeper into this. We're talking with the author of a book about how we grow and choose healthful foods. Our guest is Robert Parlberg. You're part of this conversation at 800-642-1234. More of this after the news. I'm Keeley Boltina. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. This is a conversation about food, what we eat, how we create it, and whether it all fits with our ethical standards. Our guest this hour argues we don't need organic, locally produced foods to be healthier. We just need to stop choosing highly processed options that aren't good for us. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Our guest is Robert Parlberg. He's written a book called Resetting the Table, which is about how we grow food and how we eat it. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go now to Thomas in Butler. Hi, Thomas.
Hello. I am calling in because I'm actually implementing an organic program at my workplace, a food manufacturer here in Wisconsin. And I half agree with your guest, and I half disagree. I do think that the National Organic Program standards rolled out by the USDA are about 20 to 30 years out of date, and a real rehashing of some of those standards is required in order to make organic serve its purpose and be scalable up. On the flip side, local, I think, really is the way to go, and we really do need to push local as much as possible. And I do take issue with one of the specific things that your guest said, which was that imported foods increases diversity. We've seen a decrease in the amount of foods that people eat due to monoculture, especially with annuals. So I think local perennial foods that are local and endemic to where you live are a great way to improve diversity, quite the opposite of what your guest indicated at the beginning of the program. And I'll take my response off air.
Thomas, thank you so much for bringing up those points, giving us a call at 800-642-1234. And Robert Parlberg, want to give you a chance to respond, especially on this issue of trying to figure out what a diverse diet really looks like and where we can find healthful foods, because you and Thomas disagree.
Well, we may disagree. I'm not absolutely certain of
that. Okay.
I think we agree that a healthy diet has to be a diverse diet, and it has to include fruits and vegetables. And I think I mentioned that currently only 1 in 10 Americans is getting the recommended servings of fruits and vegetables. But I don't think that these products are unavailable in our current food system. If you look at once again, at official data, you will find that since 1970, in the United States, per capita fruit availability in the marketplace has increased by 40%. Per capita vegetable availability has increased by 20%. We have three times as many tomatoes on the market per capita today as we did in 1970. We have 13 times as much broccoli on the market as we did in 1970. I don't think it's a lack of availability. Also, it's not cost. The cost of these products in the marketplace has been declining for decades at roughly the same rate as the cost for unhealthy foods. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture has a thrifty food plan that they outline that meets all dietary requirements for a family of four. And they've been able to show that you can follow that thrifty food plan at a highly affordable cost of less than $2 per meal. One reason we don't follow that plan isn't the absence of healthy foods on the marketplace. It's the fact that following that plan requires actual cooking. You have to spend 2 hours a day in meal preparation and cleanup. And most Americans these days spend only about 35 minutes a day on food preparation and cleanup. The other reason is, of course, taste. I mentioned what the food companies do to make unhealthy products virtually addictive.
Certainly, and some people may not be able to spend that much time on food prep or actually not want to. Something that seems a little bit related to this is your concept of food swamps. We've heard about food deserts before, but you think food swamps are also a big issue. What is that?
Well, a food desert is a neighborhood that lacks ready access to supermarkets. A food swamp has been defined as a neighborhood that has a ratio of unhealthy places to buy food, like fast food restaurants and corner bodegas, to a high ratio of those places to supermarkets. And this has now been studied pretty carefully, and the result of the studies show that there's very little connection between obesity rates and food deserts. And when you control for the presence of food swamps, the impacts of food deserts completely disappear. In fact, a food swamp now, in our food swamps that surround us all the time, include supermarkets. If you go to the average supermarket in the United States today, most of the foods in the center of the store are unhealthy. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation did a study, and they found that only 30% of these products could be considered healthy, the packaged products in the center of the store, and 90% of them are ultra-processed. And this is dangerous because studies have shown that when foods are consumed in an ultra-processed as opposed to a minimally processed form, we eat much too fast. Our stomach doesn't have time to announce to the brain that it's full and we should stop. And so on average, we consume 508 calories more every day. So I would like to, instead of building more supermarkets to try to fill up the food deserts, I think we have to put policies in place that will begin to drain the food swamps.
Our guest is Robert Parlberg, a political scientist who specializes in international agriculture and food policy. He also wrote a book called Resetting the Table. And we're taking your input. You can email ideas@WPR.org. We've got Michael from Appleton ready to join the conversation over the phone. Hey, Michael.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I love the show. Love WPR. And funny coincidence, there was a guy who called in a few callers ago who was an agriculture professor. I am not, but my grandfather was at Ohio and then at UW-Madison. But that's besides the point. What I wanted to say is, I've been listening, and for me, it's not so much about the organic, whether or not it's organic. I don't think there hasn't been shown that I've seen a whole lot of study that's shown that organic foods, you know, are really any substantially better for you than non-organic foods. But what gives me pause is the resources used, not just to grow the food, but to transport it with the supply chain and how much greenhouse gases and everything that's produced from moving food, say avocados that are grown in California to Wisconsin. That's what I'm sort of more trying to be more conscious of. And then I guess I'd just like to hear the guest's thoughts on that. And then what I think is really cool, or what I think are really cool, and I'd love to see more of, are vertical farms. Some of those are just absolutely wild. And if anybody listening hasn't seen some images of vertical farms, they should go check them out because they're super, super cool.
Michael, thank you so much. I want to make sure that Robert has an opportunity to respond. And Michael's last point there about vertical farms, some people believe that there's a really great option here, and some people are pretty skeptical of these. Robert.
Well, some vertical farms have succeeded, mostly growing baby greens for local restaurants. But so far, the total production from these operations is tiny, and many have not been commercially successful. It turns out that that urban properties have to pay higher taxes. Labor costs are much higher. These vertical farms have high energy costs. It's hard to make them a commercial success, although I agree they're innovative and a spectacular demonstration of ingenuity. But back to the food miles question that was mentioned earlier, we've learned when looking at transport costs in our food system that they constitute only about 4% of the costs of our food system, which is now, as I say, been globalized, and yet transport costs are still only about 4%. And the carbon emissions from the transportation that does take place aren't determined by the distance the food travels. Instead, they tend to be determined by the mode of transport and the load size. If you put food in a refrigerated container and move it by ocean freight or by rail over a vast distance, the greenhouse gas emissions per pound of food will be tiny. On the other hand, if you grow food locally and if you put it in a pickup truck and drive it in a small load to a farmer's market, and if the consumer then gets in the family vehicle and drives to that market and puts a small load, say a bag of tomatoes, in the back of the car and drives home, the carbon footprint of each tomato is actually very large. So it's load size and it's mode of transport rather than distance that determines the carbon footprint of a farming system or farm transport systems.
And that's also making the assumption that when we say food, we're talking about healthful, fresh foods. I mean, the transportation question is still relevant when you are talking about shipping highly processed foods across oceans.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're talking with Robert Parlberg, who is the author of a new book and also a political scientist. His book is called Resetting the Table. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. Thanks for joining us here on The Morning Show. Our conversation continues on the Ideas Network. We are talking about our food. How sustainable and ethical are our practices? The right way to grow and provide the world with nutritious food for our time and generations ahead. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Our guest is Robert Parlberg. In his book, he says global food markets have improved our diets, and he says large-scale farming can provide efficient, good nutrition while conserving environmental resources. And your questions are welcome here on the Ideas Network at 800-642-1234. We've got Julie in Huntley, Illinois, ready to talk with us. Good morning, Julie.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me on. I'm a registered licensed dietitian. I just wanted to agree with Robert about the fact that organic foods aren't always healthier. What people don't always think about is that organic food sits in the grocery store longer, typically, which decreases their nutritional value. So sometimes, unless you're shopping at a grocery store that has really high turnover of organic foods, you may actually be doing yourself a disservice and paying a high price tag for that. I just also wanted to comment that a lot of people are very judgmental to others who aren't buying organic food. It almost seems like it's trendy to buy organic food. They may go into a grocery store and buy like a Kung Pao chicken or something that's organic and think that that's better for them. But again, I agree with him in saying we just need to get people to eat healthier. And that's the bottom line, whether it's conventional or not. If we can get them to eat healthier, that's the direction we need to go in this country.
Julie, thank you so much for that call. And Robert, we've got a registered dietitian here who's saying we have to eat better. And you make the same argument. You say we need to choose better foods. We need to move away from the processed foods and just make better choices in our diets to deal with things like the obesity epidemic we have.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. And the caller makes an important point about the nutrient content of fresh produce. If it's not properly stored and if it's not purchased and consumed quickly, the nutrient content can deteriorate. If you put a freshly picked head of lettuce under the hot sun in the summertime, the nutrient content will decrease quickly, almost by the hour. You're better off if you have the equipment on the farm to refrigerate in the field immediately after picking, and then keep it in a cold chain all the way to the chilled counter in the supermarket. That's the way to protect the nutrient content of fresh produce. It isn't whether it's organically grown or not.
And what about this idea, too, though, of making better choices when it comes to the foods that we eat? What point do you want people to understand from your perspective?
Well, very frankly, I want people to be highly suspicious when food companies say that we have to take personal responsibility for what we eat. They say, don't blame us. You're buying our foods. You're putting them in your mouth. It's your responsibility, not ours, if you consume too much and if you have adverse health consequences. But stop and think about that for a minute. I mentioned earlier that obesity rates in the United States are three times as high today as they were in the 1960s. It can't possibly be true that eaters in the United States are three times as irresponsible. So what I would like to do is, it's hard for an individual food company to take the addictive, crave-worthy foods in their product line off the market. If their competitors don't do the same thing, they'll lose market share. So I think we need policy interventions. And I'll be honest, I think we need excise taxes on sugar-sweetened beverages. I would like to see mandatory front of package nutrition guidance for manufactured foods. And I would like to see restrictions on advertising food to children. Now, when I say these things, some of my friends back in Indiana where I grew up accused me of joining the food police. And it can sound like that. But as I say, we have a public health crisis around poor diets, and we have to take public health measures.
Robert Parlberg is a research associate at the Harvard Kennedy School, and we're talking about his book, Resetting the Table, Straight Talk About the Food We Grow and Eat. And Chuck from Spring Valley is ready to talk with us. Welcome to the Ideas Network, Chuck.
Hi, thanks for having me. So I work with farmers throughout the Midwest and based in Wisconsin. I used to work on organic farms. And I think an error that our movement makes a lot of times is talking about how all this is about individual choice, like you were just talking about. And I don't think it's about individual choice either way. I think this is all about food sovereignty. If people are sovereign over their food and how it's grown and where it's grown and what kinds of food they're eating, then like cultures will, basically all human cultures produce food that are healthy and balanced, except for those dominated by capitalism and colonization. So it's impossible to have food sovereignty with corporate control of the ag industry and land ownership being concentrated in so few hands. And it's extremely difficult for Black, Indigenous, and people of color to access land. Most of the people who live in food apartheid areas are BIPOC people. And so they systematically are denied access to land and the resources necessary to have successful farms. And that is even more impossible in a corporatized system of agriculture like the conventional system.
Chuck, thank you so much for that. And Robert, how do you respond?
Well, the food sovereignty movement is an interesting movement, and I spend about a half of a chapter in my book looking at it. And so I'd invite you to take a look at that. It's a movement that was launched 20 years ago or more in response to globalization. And the anxiety was that poor farming communities in the developing world were being crushed by the expansion of corporate capitalism. And I look at that. I do a lot of work in Africa, and one of the poorest countries in Africa with some of the worst nutrition outcomes is Ethiopia. I've worked in Ethiopia. Ethiopia was never colonized, and it's never really been a capitalist country. It went straight from feudalism under Haile Selassie to being a Marxist country under Mengistu in the 1980s and the early 1990s. If you look at small farmers in rural Ethiopia, they're essentially cut off from the global marketplace because their road system is so poor. They live many, many kilometers from the nearest market town. There aren't any multinational corporations to be seen anywhere because it's so expensive to move things around. They have to produce 60% of the food that they eat on their own farm. And that's so laborious and it takes so much time, they don't have time to do anything else. And so they remain caught in a poverty trap, and their children are stunted and wasted and malnourished. So I take a somewhat different view. I don't think that that international markets are the source of all problems for farmers or for eaters. I would like to see much larger public investments in things like roads and rural electricity and irrigation. That's what's holding back farmers in Ethiopia and in much of the rest of the developing world.
Robert, there are so many things that we weren't able to talk about, from imitation meats to animal welfare, GMOs and additional labeling. There's certainly a lot to talk about here, and I really want to thank you for the time you've been able to spend with us.
It's my pleasure. I enjoyed it. And thanks to the callers for engaging.
Absolutely. Robert Parlberg is a research associate at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's also a political scientist specializing in international agriculture and food policy. Robert is the author of the book Resetting the Table, Straight Talk About the Food We Grow and We Eat. You can continue this conversation. What are you thinking about? What ideas do you have for us to discuss here on The Morning Show? Email ideas@WPR.org with your continued questions and the things that are happening in your world as you think about the food that we eat and grow and produce. Thanks for being with us here on The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina, and you're listening to The Ideas Network.